We have a Trump meme coin almost at $50 billion. There was a crypto ball in Washington, D.C., and there's already movement out of the SEC and CFTC. To help me cover through all of this news is Alex Thorne, who is the head of firm-wide research at Galaxy Digital. He's a proud Bitcoin-flavored patriot, a New Yorker, and a regular patron at PubKey, the beloved Bitcoin pub located in Manhattan. Alex, welcome back to Bankless.
Yeah, David, great to be here. A lot to talk about. What a weekend.
Yeah, dude, I have never, like, every once in a while, something happens where there's just so much news consolidated into just a few days. And Alex, you've kind of been at the center of all of it. You were down in Washington, D.C. at the crypto ball, also just kind of watching all the shenanigans going on down there. I know you've been commenting on the Ross Ulbricht pardon. Overall, kind of just give me a summary of your sentiments and thoughts over the last, like, 4 days of activity out of the Trump administration in crypto.
Yeah, it's been a whirlwind. We were a sponsor of the crypto ball and we were there in force. That was a celebration, I would say, of by crypto, for Bitcoin and crypto, right? It was put on by David Bailey and David Sachs, and with a bunch of industry sponsors like Galaxy and MetaMask and Sui and Coinbase and Exodus Wallet, Anchorage, I think, and others, MicroStrategy, others that I think in the end, it was many sponsors. That just started the weekend, right? Because the entire weekend was filled with events related to the inaugural, some of them official. Many companies, regardless of who is elected president, give money to the presidential inaugural committee, which then funds the celebrations and events all around, the parade, security, all that type of stuff. And an enormous amount of the money that was raised for President Trump's inaugural committee also came from crypto firms. So throughout the weekend, there were events that we and others attended that were filled with executives from crypto firms. I mean, Brian Armstrong's, Jesse Powell's, Michael Saylor was all over the place. Obviously, David Sachs, who's the incoming crypto and AI czar. Tons of others, folks from Bitcoin Inc. and Sergey Nazarov, altcoin founders were all over the place. I mean, it was really very visible crypto throughout the weekend. I think overall the weekend was very celebratory. Not, you know, some minor protests in DC, but nothing like what was expected. You know, you saw like local shop owners putting up, because they've gone through this before. And by the way, in many past inaugurals, one side or the other is, you know, upset, and they put up, you know, put wood on their glass windows. Didn't see any real issues while I was there, except for the fact that it was extremely cold. I know in New York it was extremely cold as well. Really high security, really fun time, and just a lot of anticipation about what is to come for the digital assets industry in this administration.
The last time we had you on was right after the election, and I remember you calling this the golden age for crypto, at least the golden age for crypto in America, because of what the crypto industry was anticipating might be coming. And like I said in the intro, we're under 48 hours in. There's already been a presidential pardon of Ross Ulbricht. This SEC is already making moves. Is this what this looks like? Or are we imagining things? Or is this the actual, you said it was the golden age of crypto. Is this just what this looks like coming down the pipe?
Yeah, I think we're off to a great start. I mean, it's funny watching like Bitcoin Twitter, crypto Twitter broadly, sort of like think that the president was going to, you know, take the oath of office on like a pocket copy of Satoshi's white paper, right? And that you would get like within, you know, minutes or hours, like action on our issues. Even people were saying that, you know, the president, then nominee, at one point later president-elect, now president, had promised to free Ross on day one. And because it wasn't in one of like the first like seven executive orders that he signed literally in the first like 8 hours of his presidency on January 20th on Monday, people were already saying that he didn't keep his promise. Of course, he did pardon Ross during the first full day of his presidency. That was last night on January 21st. Look, the president, even in the first campaign, he campaigned on two primary slogans: make America great again and promises made, promises kept. And he's been, I think, already very he stayed very true to what he has said so far. I mean, some of his promises don't matter anymore. He said he would fire Gary Gensler. Well, Gary Gensler resigned, right? He said he would free Ross day one.
I count that.
Yeah, we'll take it. And not just at the Bitcoin conference, but also even before that at the Libertarian National Party convention, President Trump pledged to free Ross Ulbricht on day one. And he did. I think, by the way, that was an extremely for crypto. Obviously, look, I'm a supporter of getting Ross out of jail. He obviously broke the law. I think a double life sentence plus 40 years is an extreme and egregious sentence for what he did. I think and certainly what he was convicted of, I should say, which did not include things like ordering assassinations. He was never convicted of that. As far as I know, they never found victims of those alleged crimes. So I'm supportive of it, but also I think it's quite bullish for the promises made, promises kept. Now, I think it doesn't mean that he's going to do everything that he said, but I think if he didn't do this, you'd really have to wonder, really have to wonder if he was going to follow through. But of course he did it, and was quite proud to say it, as you showed here on the screen. So, I think we're just off to a good start. You've got Mark Ueda as the acting chair of the SEC. You've got Hester Peirce, who will chair the crypto task force at the SEC, which I view as just a normal, strong first step to figuring out what they're going to do and sort of getting the ball rolling. That's already happened. So I view it as we're off to a great start. I think this is what it looks like.
Yeah, we have a Donald Trump Jr. tweeting out a picture of Donald Trump tweeting on Truth Social, or truthing on Truth Social, just saying, "I called the mother of Ross William Ulbricht to let her know that in honor of her and the libertarian movement, which supported me so strongly, that it was my pleasure to just have signed a full and unconditional pardon of her son, Ross." I could not imagine receiving that call of the mother of a son who has been in jail for 13 years, who was going to be in jail for a double life sentence plus 40 years. The Free Ross Twitter account, which has been relentlessly trying to garner support for the pardoning of Ross Ulbricht, tweeted out, "Ross has just been granted a full and unconditional pardon by Donald Trump. Words cannot express how grateful we are. President Trump is a man of his word, and he just saved Ross's life. Years. Ross is a free man." And this has 62,000 likes, which is a very big tweet. We got this picture of Ross walking out in a parking lot, a free man with a bag of his stuff and a little tiny plant with a big old smile on his face. And I actually kind of want to just draw the attention to Lynn Ulbricht, who I wouldn't be surprised if you have met her in your travels, Alex. I met her at Bitcoin 2019, where she was collecting signatures for the pardoning, for the release of her son. And she has just been pushing this movement forward. One of the best moms that there ever was. I cannot imagine. I know Ross is happy, but I also cannot imagine how incredibly relieved Lynn Ulbricht was. How would you place this into history as the legacy of Bitcoin and the legacy of crypto? Ross Ulbricht, of course, founder of the Silk Road dark market, which was known for selling illegal drugs and other paraphernalia and other things that would not be savory or legal to buy or sell in any other capacity. And he went to jail for that, for a big saga. We actually had the FBI agent who kind of led the arrest of Ross Ulbricht on the podcast to hear his side of the story, which I thought was pretty interesting.
But was that Chris Tarbell?
That was Chris Tarbell. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how would you frame this in the context of the legacy of Bitcoin?
It's a really, I think, poignant bookend to what, I mean, think about this. The Silk Road at the time was quite responsible for years of, that blockchain. We love the blockchain. Great, really cool distributed ledgers. They're great. But Bitcoin, no. That's for criminals, right? Like, that's largely because of the Silk Road, that narrative. And
you mean the blockchain, not Bitcoin narrative.
Blockchain, not Bitcoin, was largely due to the Silk Road in sort of the early days of institutions looking at Bitcoin and crypto. Banks used to say this. This was like, I mean, you could even argue like the creation of RW3 and like those bank consortia from the pre-2017 era, the promotion of platforms like Hyperledger by companies was largely a reaction to this, right? And so, look, I mean, in one way, it incredibly hindered the widespread adoption of Bitcoin and digital assets because of the idea that it was associated with the Silk Road. On the other hand, look, I mean, the Silk Road, regardless, you know, and it is widely known, as you said, for facilitating the trading of nefarious items. But it also, you could buy anything on there. It was a permissionless eBay, right?
And legal and stuff. So I think legal stuff was also able to be bought and sold.
Absolutely. Tons of legal stuff. People were buying and selling memorabilia and collectibles, cars. I remember seeing. This was a lot of people's introduction, a lot of long-term Bitcoiners' introduction to Bitcoin. And this was, keep in mind too, the Silk Road was also in an era when people were still pirating a lot of movies. There was a lot of use of BitTorrent, IRC, right? This is the early days of like encrypted chat. This was an important part of what we thought the new sovereign internet could look like. And I think Ross just took it to the extreme, which is like, we're just going to make a marketplace that has anything on it, literally. Like, and it also showcased the sort of unstoppable, permissionless, censorship resistant nature of Bitcoin. So it's a mixed bag. Like I think a lot of people first learned about Bitcoin in a good way from the Silk Road, even if they didn't go on it or use it, but reading about it. And I mean, in many ways, it was the first application to ever really use Bitcoin at scale. I did also meet Lynn briefly at Bitcoin 2019. That was the conference when Ross, they played a recorded interview with Ross that he had sent in from jail, which later, apparently, the fact that he had done that, I don't know, with like a cell phone in jail, I guess you can presumably get a hold of one periodically, that they put him in the hole and in solitary confinement for doing that at the time.
Wow.
So I just think, like, regardless of what you think about what Ross did, you know, to me, a double life sentence with effectively never being convicted of any violent crime, like, is just egregious overall. So
I think that is people's general take about Ross, is that they admit that there were laws that were broken by Ross. But the double life sentence plus 40 years represents something else about the case against him that triggered the ire of the libertarian movement and, you know, even more moderate people like myself, where I just like look at that and like the outcome here doesn't make any sense. I know many people just think like the Silk Road, we just fostered illegal activity and we allowed crime to happen. And it was like a bastion of nefariousness on the internet. But myself and I think most of the crypto industry sees this as Ross created a free marketplace to actually safely do activities, buy drugs, safely do, you know, illegal things. But just because the state deems them illegal doesn't mean that they are morally negative. And he actually created a safe place, a safe haven to engage in activities. And I think that was Ross's motivation. And that's what the libertarian movement sees in it as well.
Yeah, it's kind of like a digital version of Hamsterdam in The Wire, right? I think in The Wire, the TV show, right, one of the police captains says, like, you know, our corners are destroyed by drug dealers. They're on there with guns. It's dangerous. Regular citizens can't go out and feel safe. So what if we push it all into one zone, let them freely sell their drugs there, and then you can give them needle exchange or whatever else to try to make it a little safer for them. But in the meantime, you've moved it out of the public sphere. It's a great part of The Wire, I think, in season three, I think, in The Wire. Phenomenal thing. Of course, it doesn't work. There's huge backlash. And then it goes back to the same way it is. But I think this is sort of the idea that, like, if you can create a safe place to do things that, although illegal, everyone knows they're already being done. Mm-hmm. So if you know you can't stop it, maybe there's a way to this. It sort of falls into this idea of like unenforceable prohibition, right? Like the war on drugs broadly, as an example, right? It didn't stop people from doing drugs. It hasn't stopped people from buying and selling drugs. But it has put generations of people in jail. And it has also forced this activity back out into the public square where everybody else has to live. And we don't want to have to deal with this stuff either. I'm not saying he did it out of altruism or that like this is even necessarily the right policy approach to dealing with drugs. But I think a lot of libertarians believe that like doing it in a way that was safer and private and that didn't involve, it doesn't need to involve guns and gangs on streets was perhaps a net positive in the scheme of things.
Yeah. And it does align with the philosophy to me that Bitcoin is a money of peace. Unlike the US dollar, which is defended by the United States military and the military industrial complex, Bitcoin is defended by proof of work miners. And that philosophy extends, this is kind of some deep Bitcoinerism, but that philosophy extends to the downstream effects of what Bitcoin does to the world. One question I have for you, Alex, is like, do you think Ross has any Bitcoins left over? There's this one tweet from Joe Connor Rogan saying, I found 430 Bitcoin across dozens of wallets associated with Ross Ulbricht that were not confiscated by the US government and has been untouched for 13 years. I know that there are Bitcoins that the government does have that Ross, in theory, might have a claim on, maybe not. What do you think about this? Do you think Ross Ulbricht has any Bitcoins?
Man, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't recall the specifics of what he had to agree to hand over at the time. Look, I mean, we it's possible we may never know. It's possible he or someone else who has the keys to these coins might not move them for 20 years, and then eventually they might move, right? So, I mean, there's no real way to know. I did tweet yesterday that I was wondering about, there is a sizable chunk of Bitcoin still held by the US government. It's not exactly right. There was a bunch of debate a couple of weeks ago about whether they were selling some of their remaining Silk Road Bitcoin. This one. And, you know, that the individual X, the government has never said who that person is. They did a civil forfeiture legal case. There was an activist or a person, Barnbridge, that was trying to sue the government, saying that individual X's coins were theirs, but all of that was finalized as no evidence that they were theirs, and then all legal proceedings finished at the end of the year. That resulted in that tweet from DB10K that got everybody nervous at the, you know, in early January about whether they were selling. Those coins still haven't moved on chain, so we don't know. And then you look at this other pile that's DOJ held Silk Road. I think those might be the last remaining coins from Jimmy Zong, the guy that was arrested in like Atlanta, Georgia area. And he had just like clicked withdrawal a whole bunch of times. And I guess there was a bug on the Silk Road website and he amassed like 50 or 60,000 coins. In my mind, like maybe like if those were stolen from the Silk Road, Ross might have a claim on them if he has a full and unconditional pardon. That means it's as if the crimes never occurred, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. A lawyer who I think highly of, Joe Carlisair, on Twitter pointed out a Supreme Court ruling, which I believe was related to a blanket amnesty for after the Civil War, saying that that the general pardon and amnesty granted did not allow individuals to get the proceeds back, right? But if those were previously condemned and sold under Confiscation Act. But again, Joe's a smart lawyer, but this is a pretty specific ruling. It specifically says under that act, mm-hmm. It also refers to a general pardon and amnesty, not a full and unconditional pardon of a specific person. So I don't think anybody really knows. And I think this ruling or not wouldn't maybe prevent Ross from claiming some of them. I don't know. It's, to me, it seems unlikely. And don't get me wrong, I think he's probably very happy to be out of prison.
Yeah, he might not be concerned.
That
about
might not be enough. That might be enough. Yeah, it might be enough. But I only raise it because outside of these remaining Silk Road coins, the largest pile of coins at the U.S. government is this Bitfinex recovery,
right,
resulting from the Ilya and Razzle Khan theft of Bitfinex. Mm-hmm. That's the largest. Government says that iFinex, the owner of Bitfinex, is the only claimant. They're running a process now to see if anybody else is going to claim access to them. We assume that those will be returned in kind to Bitfinex. So those cannot probably be part of a stockpile.
Mm.
The largest chunk of, you know, coins seized as the result of crime that we know is crime was these Silk Road coins, both the individual X and these. And so you wonder if they give the Bitfinex coins back, if somehow Ross claims those coins, and even if he doesn't get them, they become part of a legal thing that takes several years. Like, you're now looking at a pretty small chunk of coins to never be sold, as the president said in Nashville, to form that national Bitcoin stockpile. So just an interesting wrinkle here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just an interesting part of the story. Again, I think you're totally right. Ross is just very happy to be free, and he's probably not concerned about the Bitcoins that he owns. To my knowledge, he's a pretty meditative Zen type individual who has like learned to separate themselves from in like tangible objects, but I think just the overall arc of the story of Ross being able to be free, a free man 13 years later and come back to a pile of Bitcoins is a pretty good part of that story.
Yeah. And who knows if it'll happen, but I mean, just what a legendary saga, honestly. And the man was in jail for a long time. I think about 12 years, if I did the math correctly. And, you know, I think he looked great though. You see that picture of him coming out of jail? I thought he looked really good. He had a plant. I mean, look at this. He looks healthy.
Walking out with a tiny little plant is, I don't know Ross well, but I have watched plenty of interviews and videos of him, and him walking out with a plant is just incredibly on brand for what I know of him.
It also, I think it's really poetic, right? It's, you know, you have this vision of him locked away and yet he's still growing and fostering new life. And it's very emblematic, I think, of the life he has ahead of him. I mean, is he 40 years old? I think
he's 40 years old. He walks away at 40 years old, which he has plenty of life left.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, he does. All right, Alex, let's turn to the Trump meme coin. The official tweet out of the Donald J. Trump Twitter account tweeted out on January 17th, "My new official Trump meme is here. It's time to celebrate everything we stand for. Winning. Join my very special Trump community. Get your ticker sign Trump now. Go to gettrumpmemes.com, which is a page that looks like this, which is a very skinny fit looking Trump with the only official Trump meme. Buy with debit card, buy now with crypto, and a Solana contract address, which leads to this Trump token on Solana that came in at the day of launch, coming in at a about a $1 billion market cap, and then immediately went up to $26 billion market cap, came in at something like an $80 billion fully diluted valuation at the peak. This people thought it was crazy. It was going up 11,000% in 24 hours. And I think this was one of the most astounding things I've seen in crypto. People were going back and forth and processing this. This additionally caused the Solana token to pump almost 50% on the week, simply because the president, incoming president at the time, chose Solana to issue his Trump coin. So Solana went from $175 to $286. The SOL price fell off down to $230, along with Trump, which lost almost 50% of its market cap when the Melania meme coin was announced, also from a tweet from Melania's Twitter account. Melania launched at a $2 billion market cap, $13.3 billion fully diluted, and then it quickly fell off to a $600 million market cap where it is today. That's a $4 billion fully diluted. The launch of Melania was not really received very well and kind of really changed the tune around people's perception of the Trump meme coin, especially when Donald Trump made no crypto-related statements or executive orders in his first day of office or in his inaugural speech. It's also worth noting that a Trump-owned company owns 80% of the supply of the relevant meme coin. So I think people are still processing this, Alex, the existence of an official Trump meme coin along with a Melania coin. What are your initial thoughts and sentiments? When you saw this tweet, what did you think?
Well, the funny thing is that he tweeted it. What time did he tweet that? Was the scroll down?
9:44 p.m., right during the crypto ball.
Yeah. So did not see this until the next morning. I know Nick O'Neill was there with some cringe videos laughing at people for not having seen it. I saw some of those on Twitter. I think that was one of the first things that people were surprised about the next morning was he released this while we were all at the crypto ball. I mean, not we all, but like a lot. I mean, no one really knew about this. I mean, I left the crypto ball at the end of the night and still hadn't heard about this and was talking with a lot of crypto people all night. Like nobody knew about this. So that was an interesting surprise. I think throughout the weekend, people went through almost the stages of grief on this, and you could see it on Twitter. At first it was disbelief, and then, you know, anger. And then I think acceptance, I think once you got to Monday, Tuesday, which is, you know, surprising, right? Because the president had already released, what, four separate collections of NFTs?
Yeah.
They'd already launched a DeFi protocol on Ethereum called World Liberty Financial.
Which is currently buying a bunch of crypto, including a lot of ETH.
Yeah. I mean, basically, that you can see there on chain wallets. Trump is famous for selling memorabilia and collectibles of all types, right? I mean, stakes and choo-choo trains and whatever else, right? So I think the surprise, especially in an industry that he has embraced, where Pump.fun and Solana meme coins were a huge part of the 2024 market narrative. I think the surprise was surprising to see, frankly, the fact that people were so surprised by this. Because again, like this fits, I think it's consistent with not only Trump's broader, past of issuing branded memorabilia, but also his activities in crypto, right? Like to me, this is relatively consistent. I think, look, and the tech is permissionless. It's, you think about this as an industry that's been calling for the creation of creator tokens and fan tokens as a new way for people to monetize and interact with their communities and audiences. Like, that's this. I'm not surprised, it caught the industry by surprise, and that was clear. I think it took most of the weekend for people to sort of come to terms with this. And then he commented on it, I think last night. Yes, he did. He commented on it. He said they asked him during a press conference, I think last night, and he was like, I don't really know anything. I think he said, I remember. And then the DB or somebody, one of those Squawk accounts, clipped the quote and said that Trump said, I don't really know about it. And that caused it to go down a lot.
Right, naturally.
But the full quote was, yeah, I don't really know much about it, except that I launched it. And then he said, where's it at right now? And they were like, I don't know, billions of dollars. But he was in the room with, I think he was maybe with Masso, is when they were talking about SoftBank's investment. And he was like, a couple billion dollars. That's nothing to these. That's peanuts to these guys. That's what he said. I just think you have to look at the whole thing with humor and say that, these are permissionless protocols. I mean, I think that's what we've been building across crypto. So I don't think anyone should be surprised when people use them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I will say my sentiments, and I think the broader market reflects this, is when Trump launched the meme coin, I was astounded. And it's like a president of the United States is launching a meme coin. This kind of is along the lines of, business. Trump loves business. He loves business opportunities. This is clearly a business profit making opportunity for him. And it's also highly aligned with the crypto industry. I think if anyone in the crypto industry launched a meme coin like this, the crypto industry would likely reject it and call it a grift. But when it's incentive compatible with what we need, which is legitimacy, adoption, and support by the crypto president that he calls himself, it's a little bit of a different tone. We can accept that. But then when the launch of the Melania coin came out, you can see that reflected in the price. And the price of the meme coin of the Donald Trump meme coin has really it lost its momentum, and it hasn't really been able to recapture its own momentum. We'll see if it can get some momentum. I think the kind of hands-off nature that Donald Trump is treating his own meme coin is, I guess, appropriate, because it is truly just a meme at this point. But wow, I kind of would like to imagine a world where the Melania meme coin was never launched, because why did they do that? Like, Melania, I'm sure, is a great, fantastic lady, but everyone cares about Donald Trump. No one really cares about Melania. Trump is the meme. He is the meme. And now it's highly dilutive, and it kind of rips off the mask of the intent. It kind of removes some of the deniability of some of the intent around the Donald Trump meme coin. At least that's my perspective.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you don't want to compete with yourself, I think, in general, if you're issuing anything, right? You don't want to have two. It should be dilutive, you'd think. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Look, that it was surprising also. I don't have much on this. I will say, yes, if you're talking about the sort of the allocation schedule, when you mentioned that, it might be seen negatively if a normal sort of crypto people launch this. I think that's probably true. I think there's no world in which people in, like where I came out of in crypto and my Bitcoin friends would think that this wasn't, that this was a fair allocation. Compare 80% of however we call this, it's not a pre-mine, it's just a pre-launch allocation versus Bitcoin's fair launch, right? There's a wide discrepancy there. But I would also say, like, there's a lot of, I'm looking at this disclosure page here on Trump's website, and there's a fairly large amount of disclosure. I think in general, this maybe a good way to say this is that it will make consumer protection more important for Democrats in these various legislative discussions on the market structure bill stuff. Because I think one thing that crypto Democrats in particular, I think, will be raising this. But I think broadly, people agree with this, that no one is asking for a free pass for digital assets in America. I don't think anyone wants to go back to the totally unregulated and Wild West ICO era of the 2017s. But I do think that, and I believe this, like, you should be able to issue a digital asset as long as you meet the requirements, particularly disclosure requirements.
Right.
That's how securities work, right? The entire process of taking a company public in America, doing an IPO or direct listing, is one of disclosures, right? Mm-hmm. All those documents, same thing with the ETFs. Remember looking at those S1s over and over again as they were amended, like, those are disclosure documents so that investors have information. So this is what I'm talking about. I think, you know, I haven't verified if these allocation schedule that you're showing here is actually hard coded into the contract, or if it's like, we just promise to do it this way. I don't know, but I do think we need to get to a place in the industry where disclosure is not only the norm, and it's gotten better as being the norm, but perhaps is the requirement and can be verified. So I think, look, this is good that it has this. Very good. Mm-hmm. It would be a lot worse if it didn't have this. I think if you know what you're buying, you know you're buying the Trump meme coin, you know, right? The other thing is, I would say we don't really want to get to, I personally think we should get somewhere away from the nanny state where, you know, only, you know, rich people can speculate as much as they want, but, you know,
but the average person, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. can't. And, yeah. And so again, with stronger disclosure rules that still, you know, make sure that at least the information is available to all types of investors, I think it still was still a shock, but I think, you know, it's consistent with what, you know, he's done in the past, and at least we've got some disclosures here. Let's get those disclosures. Let's make a pathway for the people to do it with the disclosures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I would say about the launch is that it was not a botched launch. It was a pretty acceptable launch. At least when I go to gettrumpmemes.com, what Alex is referencing here is this information about the allocation, along with a pie chart and these different groups that have different allocations. And there's these big texts that says there are 200 million Trump available on day one and will grow to a total of 1 billion Trump over 3 years. Each group's allocations are released on their own schedule over 3 years. And there's a bunch of groups labeled here, which I would like a little bit more information about what and who these groups are. Creators in CIC Digital 1s and 2 and 3, public distribution, creators in CIC Digital 4, 5, and 6. So different groups. And I don't know if there's too much information about what these groups are, but I think that would be like the missing component of information that I would like. But otherwise, it's a fully transparent supply schedule that has a little bit of missing information in it. But otherwise, I'm relatively happy with the information that as a consumer, as a potential investor, not financial advice, I'm not buying, but there's information here that is interesting as a potential Trump owner at the very least. There was some public commentary from Dave Portnoy. He tweeted out, I have a dumb two-part question. What's the difference between the Hawk Tua coin and the Trump coin besides nothing? Second question, can I string up my own coin now and tell people it's a Ponzi scheme from the jump and I'm going to rug pull at some point and you better just hope you're out when I do, and that would make the entire thing legal? And then he finishes with ticker sign Trump. I think these are hypothetical questions. And then even the event of the Trump meme coin made its way into mainstream media. The Politico article saying a horrible look, crypto lobby reels from Trump's meme coin, which includes a quote from our friend Nick Carter, who said it's absolutely preposterous that he would do this, who is a founding partner at the crypto investment firm Castline Ventures, who describes himself as an avowed and explicit Trump supporter. And another quote, they're plumbing new depths of idiocy with the meme coin launch. So even inside of the crypto industry, mixed reaction to the launch of the Trump meme coin. Alex, any final comments before we move on?
Yeah, I mean, I think Nick is reflecting what a lot of people were thinking when it happened early. But look, again, they have done pretty much everything in crypto. They're speed running their crypto world. The Trump family is, right? They were pro Bitcoin miner, I think, was the first thing that they said about Bitcoin, about in crypto. Then, well, I actually think they had launched NFTs. They'd launched ordinals. Right. I think one of the collections is on ordinals. So they did NFTs, ordinals, DeFi, talked about Bitcoin miners, went to the Bitcoin conference, talked about the stockpile, say they love Bitcoin. Then they say, never sell your Bitcoin. Then they, and the idea that they would do a meme coin, I think, is just totally on brand. I mean, it's also, you know, we talked about this on Bankless before, you and I, David, but like last year was largely this barbell market of Bitcoin on one end and the institutionalization and maturation of Bitcoin adoption on one end and meme coins on the other. I mean, really from like February through the end of the year, maybe with the AI agent coins coming in sort of later at the end of the year, which themselves are kind of meme coins also. So it doesn't surprise me, and I don't think people should be that surprised given I think it's pretty consistent with the Trump family has done in memorabilia collectibles, but also in crypto.
I also got a couple more things I want to talk to you about. You were at the Crypto Ball in Washington, D.C., but then there's also been some movement out of the SEC and the CFTC. Mark Ayuda is the new SEC chair, and then the CFTC just lifted the sanctions on Tornado Cash. I know you're not a lawyer, but I'm going to ask you some, you know, maybe related questions. But before we get to all of these topics and more, first, a moment to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make the show possible. Are you ready to swap smarter? Uniswap apps are simple, secure, and seamless tools that crypto users trust. The Uniswap protocol has processed more than $2.5 trillion in all-time swap volume, proving it's the go-to liquidity hub for swaps. With support for growing numbers of chains, including Ethereum, Mainnet, Base, Arbitrum, Polygon, ZK Sync, Uniswap apps are built for a multi-chain world. Uniswap syncs your transactions across its web interface, mobile apps, and Chrome browser extensions, so you're never tied to one device. And with self-custody for your funds and MEV protection, Uniswap keeps your crypto secure while you swap anywhere, anytime. Connect your wallet and swap smarter today with the Uniswap web app, or download the Uniswap wallet, available now in iOS, Android, and Chrome. Uniswap, the simple, secure way to swap in a multi-chain world. What if the future of Web3 gaming wasn't just a fantasy, but something you could explore today? Ronin, the blockchain already trusted by millions of players and creators, is opening its doors to a new era of innovation starting February 12th. For players and investors, Ronin is a home to a thriving ecosystem of games, NFTs, and live projects like Axie and Pixels. With its permissionless expansion, the platform is about to unleash new opportunities in gaming, DeFi, AI agents, and more. Sign up for the Ronin wallet now to join 17 million others exploring the ecosystem. And for developers, Ronin is your platform to build, grow, and scale. With fast transactions, low fees, and proven infrastructure, it's optimized for creativity at scale. Start building on the testnet today and prepare to launch your ideas, whether it's games, meme coins, or an entirely new Web3 experience. Ronin's millions of active users and wallets means tapping into a thriving ecosystem of 3 million monthly active addresses ready to explore your creations. Sign up for Ronin Wallet at wallet.roninchain.com and explore the possibilities. Whether you're a player, investor, or builder, the future of Web3 starts on Ronin. And we are back. Something that happened January 17th, which you were at, which is when, of course, Donald Trump dropped his meme coin, was the Crypto Ball. Maybe, Alex, you were there. I'm hopefully you had a good time. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about that. But what was the Crypto Ball? What was the purpose of it? Why did it happen? Shed a little context on the whole event for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was, it was put on primarily by David Sacks and David Bailey from Bitcoin Inc., right? Bitcoin Conference. I think David and his team, my guess, I don't actually know, but I think they probably, they organized it and ran the event, given that they are a big events company as well. But so you had companies from across the industry both sponsor it. I mean, I think this is a shot that shows Stand With Crypto as one of the sponsors. And it says Exodus Wallet and Kraken and Anchorage, and I think and maybe one other that I can't
see. There's a bunch on the left. There's Galaxy. There's you guys, Ondo, yeah. Solana, MicroStrategy, yeah. Coinbase, MetaMask. Wow, MetaMask. Mistin Labs, the Bitcoin Layer 2. Wow, they sponsored. Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, I think so it was a celebration for crypto. This was not an official inauguration event. I was there. I did not see the president. There. Donald Trump Jr. was there. I think other members of the incoming cabinet were there. So there were people there from sort of the administration. And I think it was a celebration put on by crypto, the crypto industry broadly, the Bitcoin and crypto industries broadly. And I think it was well deserved because it's been it was pretty surreal, you know, having gone through the you know, ranging from total ignoring us on one end to directly attacking us. I mean, a whole, I mean, it wasn't just crypto that was under attack. I mean, they proposed a 30% value added tax on Bitcoin mining at one point in a federal budget, right? It was the stuff at OFAC and FinCEN on the Bank Secrecy Act, things like Elizabeth Warren's proposed Digital Asset Anti-Money Laundering Act, that would affect all of crypto, not just, you know, it's not just about issuance and DeFi at the SEC, right? There was broad attacks on Bitcoin, Bitcoin developers, you know, the sort of the most vanilla.
Anything adjacent, anything relevant.
Yeah, truly. And so that to then be in the heart of Washington, D.C. on inauguration weekend, surrounded by people who either individually or their companies had been in the trenches, you know, fighting that fight for the last 4 years, and be able to celebrate and know that, I mean, I would say at a minimum, we expect a much more open minded and hands off approach from the new administration at a minimum. So it was pretty surreal. It was a great celebration. Snoop Dogg performed. Soulja Boy performed.
No Rick way.
Performed. Yeah. And which were funny and good. I mean, they were. And it was just it was a fun time. It became sort of a meeting place. I mean, individuals could buy tickets. They were quite pricey. I think what I was told was
$7,000 for an individual.
I think it started at $2,500.
Oh gosh,
$5,000. Then it went to higher. I mean, as the supply of tickets ran out, it was absolutely packed. To be clear, like it was packed. You were like shoulder to shoulder in some parts of that room. But I think a lot of the money will go to, I believe, some large portion of it will go to Bitcoin developer nonprofits. So I think it was a fun time to get everybody there together. And this is how we kicked off the weekend. I mean, if you were there for the whole weekend, this was Friday night. We were joking the next week, like this was actually from the Starlight Ball, that you're showing here, which was Trump's inauguration ball on Monday night after taking the oath and going to the Oval and signing after becoming president. There were things like this all weekend long. And we were thinking back on like Sunday afternoon, we were like, God, the crypto ball was like a month ago. Like we did a lot of stuff.
Sometimes going to a crypto conference feels like a marathon of just events, events, events. It kind of sounds like it was like that, except it was in Washington, D.C. and a crypto president was getting elected.
Yeah. And I'm sure other crypto firms that were there, like we were, did similar things. Like we met with members of Congress and regulatory officials and people that we know in general to, you know, check in, say hi, like figure out like how we can help with information. I mean, one of the things I think that I'm so excited about with a new administration, with a more open minded and open door approach to digital assets in general, regardless of where policies land, is they're asking for help. They want to know more about the space. They want to be educated on the space. When something new comes out, they need help learning what it is and how it works and finding how do we find data on it, right? Like that's where, you know, the industry has a lot of expertise. And so it's just nice to know that if you go in, you know, think about Robinhood, pretty famously said that they met with the SEC like 12, I think it was 12 or 13 times, or maybe Vlad had said it was a dozen times, gave a bunch of information about what they wanted to do, what they were doing, information about it. And then the SEC sued them with that information, right? I don't know if they actually ended up filing suit. I can't remember, but they definitely sent them a Wells notice, which is intent to sue them. And they complained, Robinhood, that this was unfair because it was on the back of them coming in, being very transparent, trying to help them understand, providing information. It feels like from the statements that the new guy who's taking over the FDIC said that they want an open-minded approach to innovation and technology, including fintech, digital assets, and tokenization. Obviously, with the crypto task force that's now been established at the SEC, it feels similar. Again, not saying they're going to come out with rules that are exactly what the digital assets industry wants, but they're very, very clearly signaling that the door is open. So it wasn't just these celebratory balls. It was also a lot of meetings and, you know, breakfasts and catching up with people that you know and coffees. And it was a lot, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and that does kind of lead us into something that's going on at the SEC. Mark Ueda, who is the pro-crypto compatriot to Hester Peirce, that I think more Bankless listeners are familiar with Hester Peirce, but Mark Ueda and Hester Peirce have really been leading the dissents against the SEC. SEC chairs that are commissioners that are leading the dissents against Gary Gensler and his anti-crypto campaign. And he, Mark Ueda, has been named the SEC chair, while a real the official Trump appointee is we're still waiting for that appointee, that name. So in the interim, Mark Ueda is the SEC chair, and there has been some movements going on. The SEC has announced a new crypto task force announced by Mark Ueda, along with Hester Peirce. Apparently is going to lead this task force. And a tweet from you, Alex, that I read this morning: SEC schedules closed door meetings for Thursday, January 23rd. That's tomorrow. The topics include institution and settlement of injunction actions, institution and settlement of administrative proceedings, resolution of litigation claims, and other matters relating to examinations and enforcement proceedings. Alex, can you just like read between the lines for me here? Like, spell this out clearly. Yeah. What's going on over here?
Yeah. So Commissioner Ueda is a great supporter of digital assets in general. Again, when we say that, we don't mean that they're like going to like let us do whatever we want and have no rules at all. But, you know, he very strongly and clearly favors a more progressive approach to regulating in general that includes working with industry to find something that is possible. Right. So I think it's a great choice. I think, and by the way, I know some of his staff, they're also very smart on crypto, actually real crypto. So yeah, with that meeting, I should have been a little clearer. That meeting is a recurring, they do that meeting a lot, right? That's part of the normal business of the SEC. However, this will be the first one that has Mark, and Hester as the majority, right? I think the other two have already resigned. So, right, Gensler has resigned, and I think Crenshaw has resigned.
Caroline Crenshaw.
They do have a 2-1 majority, so they can actually move even without Paul Atkins, who's been named as Trump's chair of the SEC. He probably won't be confirmed by the Senate until, I mean, I don't know, April or May. I think Gensler was confirmed in April. Jay Clayton before him was confirmed in May. So like it's not like the Treasury's, you know, Marco Rubio was confirmed for state Secretary of State like a night and a half ago, right? They're going to move. There's only so much floor time available in the Senate to actually do these confirmations. And there are certainly other positions that are more important to urgently do than the SEC chair. So we expect that Paul will come into office sometime in April or May. In the interim, though, with the establishment of this crypto task force, which will be led by Hester Peirce, the other, you know, Republican appointed commissioner, and which, by the way, will include Rich Gabbert, who is a senior advisor to Mark Ueda, and Taylor Asher, also a senior advisor to Mark Ueda, both very smart on crypto. With the establishment of that task force, I think you're going to start to see them move on things like halting enforcements or at least pausing to review them, right? This group that now controls the SEC was not in the majority that decided on bringing a lot of these court cases or high profile enforcement. So
they dissented against them.
Yeah. So this meeting, which is specifically about reviewing the current state of litigation and enforcements, is now being run by a majority that is opposed to the prior approach. So I think you will start to see them get to work here. And I mean, we when we talked right after the election, and I said this, and we published a report called The Digital Golden Era, which is all about what to expect. And one of the first things we wrote was that we expect to see a widespread halting of enforcements in crypto pending further review and possibly the pausing or withdrawing of major litigation. I think it's very likely that in the next month or two, you'll see the SEC file in court in major cases like with Coinbase, at least something to the effect of, hey, Your Honor, we may actually be reevaluating our approach to this entire case. I think it doesn't mean they're going to immediately file I think the task force is sort of the first step to them figuring out, like, you know, where do we want to go? Yeah, we know where point A is. That's where we are now. But where do we want point B to be? And then what is the actual process to get there? I think they're going to it's not going to happen right away. But I think I would be shocked. I mean, the meeting tomorrow is a closed door meeting. That's why it's published under the Sunshine Act, meaning it's internal SEC meeting. So I don't know whether we'll learn anything about what is actually said there. But I mean, if this group is here talking about what to do with enforcements and litigations, I think this is the start of them changing their approach.
Yeah. And like you said, we're not expecting nor asking for just a blank check from these more pro-crypto SEC commissioners. I think what, reading between the lines, they are going to go case by case of individual enforcement actions and evaluating each individual one to see if they, what they want to do with each individual one. They disagreed with many of them, but they're not just going to throw every single one out the door. They're going to evaluate each one by its merits and decide what's right and what's best and what's fair for the mandate of the SEC, which is fair and orderly markets. Which is something that I think the crypto industry feels that the SEC has not been doing. They had some undisclosed secret mandate. And I think we all kind of have faith that Hester Peirce and Mark Ueda will act in accordance with the actual mandate of the SEC. At least that's what I'm hopeful for, which is fair and orderly capital markets. Something that came out this morning, which I mistakenly called the CFTC, but this is actually OFAC. This was breaking this morning. Court lifts OFAC sanctions on Tornado Cash, marking a major win for crypto privacy advocates. So it turns out this is actually not anything to do with Donald Trump, but the timing of this is just, you know, another good cherry on top for crypto industry wins. This is part of the arc of crypto wins in the court. This is the Joseph Van Loon, Preston Van Loon, Alex Fisher, Kevin Vitale, and a few others, their court case, the Coinbase-sponsored court case against OFAC about the illegality of Tornado Cash. This tweet, which is a Cointelegraph, reads, "Court lifts OFAC sanctions," which to me makes it seem that going and using Tornado Cash is legal. I am going to wait for multiple lawyers' confirmations on this on Twitter before I even go anywhere near Tornado Cash. But Alex, have you processed any of this? What's your reaction here?
Yeah, so the ruling, this is a publishing of the ruling that came out in November, which is great. It's remanded back to the district court to figure out what to do with it. And it, my understanding is either it will become legal for the plaintiffs in the case, like Van Loon and others, to use Tornado Cash, or it will become legal for everyone to use Tornado Cash in general. I think the ruling explicitly said that Tornado Cash smart contracts are not property, and that's important because the authorizing legislation that allows OFAC to sanction foreign individuals and entities, meaning things, doesn't have an exception for whatever a smart contract is, which is why OFAC said, well, smart contract is property, and that's what allowed them to do the sanctions. And so I think this is a big deal. I think there was plenty of also language in the ruling that was supportive of it wasn't just a niche like, well, it's not property and we don't care what it is, but since it's not property, send it back. That's sort of the legal justification for the ruling. But there was a lot of language that, I mean, they said the fact that the smart contracts didn't have upgradability was a big feature, couldn't be controlled by any party, makes it impossible for it to be property if nobody actually controls it, right? It was a well-reasoned argument, and I think it's very positive. I think this is one of the most important issues, by the way, that the administration is, I would say, less likely to sort of give the industry what it wants, which is some relief from the stuff at Treasury, right? So FinCEN, what we call TFI, Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Wing of the Treasury Department, which oversees FinCEN and OFAC. It's not, and not saying because maybe they don't want to or might not try, but think about it, in a post 9/11 world, it's very difficult to justify, maybe easier to justify, very difficult to argue about relaxing things that involve illicit finance, right? And it's just very tough to argue that, you should be able to. I mean, let's face it, North Korea did use Tornado Cash a lot. Like, it's right. So, user. Right. So like that, it's hard to make that case. So it's great to see the courts here, because politically it's going to be more difficult, I think, to get, elected officials and appointed officials to support a more libertarian view of how this should go. But on the other hand, to me, I think it is the right thing. If it can't be upgraded, it is literally the internet, you don't put Microsoft CEO in jail because a Al-Qaeda manifesto was typed in Microsoft Word. Like, it's not, if it is truly a decentralized tool, which is what the court has basically said Tornado Cash is, then it really doesn't make sense to criminalize the people that merely authored it, right? You should really focus on the people that used it for illegal activities. The other thing I want to point out too, that gets lost a lot. Privacy in finance is not illegal at all. It's not even intentionally obfuscating the origin of funds is not money laundering.
Right.
For it to be money laundering, the funds themselves have to also emanate and be proceeds of crime. Right. Mm. So Vitalik sending donations to Ukraine through Tornado Cash, which I believe he said he did. Mm-hmm. That's not money laundering, even though he is obfuscating that it came from him.
Right.
Right. You're totally allowed to use private, be private. Wealthy people in particular do this all the time. Right. Corporations, even in Delaware and in the Dakotas, where they have strong corporate privacy, right, like are structured to give people privacy. It's merely illegal if you also are doing it to hide the origin of illicit funds. So people deserve privacy. I hope that will. And by the way, I hope the same ruling or outcome will eventually happen for something like Samurai Wallet as well. And CoinJoin providers that I don't know if the legal facts are exactly, you know, comparable or whatever. But in general, I think we're supportive of tools for privacy, and we're also supportive of tools to help law enforcement catch bad guys, and that's what the court and the government are going to have to figure out the way forward. I am happy that it seems like the court here, possibly also the government now, will be at least slightly tilted a little closer to our view of this.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that kind of brings me to maybe the last question I have for you, Alex, is just that we have momentum right now. We have the courts, which are consistently giving wins to the crypto industry. We have Donald Trump pardoning crypto people, crypto supporters like Ross Ulbricht. And also just generally just we have a lot of momentum across the board. Maybe if you could just, you know, think for a moment and come up with a wish list of what we want. I know Vitalik Buterin tweeted out "No Man Left Behind" after talking about the pardoning of Ross Ulbricht. He tweeted out "Roman Storm and Alexei Pertsev are next." These are the two developers behind Tornado Cash. Tornado Cash, again, with the announcement that we just read that a court has lifted a ban on Tornado Cash, does it make sense that the Tornado Cash developers are in jail? Roman Storm and Alexei Pertsev, I believe Alexei Pertsev is in jail in the Netherlands, but Roman Storm is potentially going to jail in the United States. He is living in Seattle, Washington as of right now. And so maybe a wish list of future things that you would be hopeful for as it relates to OFAC and Tornado Cash, or just, you know, Bitcoin mining, anything. What comes to mind first for you, Alex?
Well, I think when it comes to Roman and Alexei, or the Samurai Wallet guys, or let's stick with them as two relatively similar examples. You know, they're not charged by the federal prosecutor specifically with having deployed the smart contracts, right? They have the charges are involved, I think, primarily the front end, and specifically not banning the IPs of the North Korean actors even after they knew. So there are some facts, I think, that are a little, that are harmful to them and that relate more specifically to the charges they're actually being charged with. That doesn't mean that I support, you know, pointing that out, just to be very clear, that doesn't mean I'm not supportive of them having some relief here in one way or another. I mean, you could also, for all we know, see a different approach taken in their criminal case, specifically Romans in the U.S. I really can't speak to the Netherlands. I did see it seemed like he was being treated terribly. He was held for months, Alexei, without, I think, being even charged. So, I mean, I'm opposed to that. I want due process. It's possible you could get a better approach from the prosecutor in Roman's case anyway, maybe. I do think this is a great fact for his case, right? I mean, if it's not illegal, then
what did he do
on its face? Then I mean, the case is definitely, I would say it's pretty safe to say it's probably weakened the federal prosecutor's case against Roman. Would love to see some resolution here overall that's positive. I think either way, you're going to have the ability to. It looks like we have to wait and see what this district court says with this remanding back to them. But it looks like we could be at a place where you can deploy immutable, non-upgradable privacy contracts and have that not be illegal as possible. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe you can't profit off them. Maybe if there is something you control, like a front end. By the way, DeFi also broadly, I think you've talked about this in the past, but regardless of who's president and regardless of who's in the regulatory seats, DeFi needs to get to locally run front ends, because the operator of a front end is always going to be somewhat responsible, and they should be, Right. It's why Uniswap doesn't show like a whole bunch of tokens they don't show. Right. I mean, they because that is they're hosting. They are effectively like Coinbase Wallet is to the rest of DeFi. Like they are, they may not be a broker, but they certainly can limit what you can go
do
to
things,
there. Yeah. So I think
it falls under the category that we like at Bankless, which is if it can be regulated, then it perhaps ought to be regulated. And if it can't be regulated because it's decentralized, then it shouldn't.
I mean, it's the same thing, like why we don't think about like a open source, locally run wallet, you know, take like Bitcoin Core or Geth or something, Like like that can't be regulated. It's literally a piece of code, right? But a front end website where I log in, you ask me for information, then it's like, well, I mean, maybe you could be regulated. So, which by the way is also okay, but I just mean, I hope that for DeFi to become more resilient, for founders to not, you know, face this kind of threat, whether in the US or abroad. I mean, if you don't clip a fee and you don't store data and you don't host a front end, that's should be okay. Now you're looking a lot like Satoshi, to be honest, right? Like, so I hope we get more to that. I think to your question, I mean, I think we want to see, I think you just got to chill and let this play out. I mean, I think crypto Twitter has relaxed a little bit since Ross's pardon, which is I think everybody needs to take a little bit of a chill pill. Everything appears to be happening as so far as promised. And I think you know, there's just a lot of priorities. You can't expect the president, people don't even realize that there's a debt ceiling limit debate that has to happen. Like the US government is about to run out of money. So Congress is going to be all tied up dealing with that, right? And negotiations around that for a while. So a couple of weeks and stuff. So like, there's a lot of high priority stuff that although the digital assets industry gave a lot of support to the president, so did a lot of other people and a lot of
other industry in America. Yeah.
It is not literally a crypto Congress. Sure, there is a lot of crypto support in Congress, but it is America's Congress. They've got other issues to work on. So I think people just relax and chill and you know, wait and see what's going to happen. I think so far at FDIC and SEC and CFTC, where Carolyn Pham was elevated to acting chair too, you've got in three of the most important FinReg seats, much more open-minded, possibly supportive people in charge. And you've still got, I mean, even Scott Bessent, who's very likely to be confirmed soon. I mean, the Treasury Secretary is very important, I mean, in terms of the government operating. He's signaled plenty of support for digital assets in the past. So I think you're looking at everything looks like ready to go here. So it's hard to know. I don't want to speculate too much, but I'll do one specific. I'm hoping that, you know, a good friend of mine, Omid Malaykhan, who's a professor at Columbia Business School.
We had him on the pod not too long ago.
Oh, great. I love Omid. He was saying something really interesting about tokenization, which was that we all who were in crypto a long time used to think that it would help bring liquidity to illiquid assets. And I looked at dozens of platforms when I did VC at Fidelity to tokenize stuff. And like some of them were explicitly for real estate, right? And remember there was the St. Regis and Aspen that was partially tokenized and all this stuff. None of that ended up being true, right? Illiquid, it turned out that, you know, you don't want liquidity sometimes or other, like, you know, you don't want to wake up and find that for some reason someone dumped your house's token overnight. Now your house is right? Like, and also there's other advantageous reasons why things might not want to be marked to market, right? Venture investors, as an example, like they don't have to mark their stuff to market. You know, maybe they do it quarterly or annually, but like they don't want it to be live, right? So there were other reasons why that wasn't true, that it didn't. Its primary reason for tokenization was not bringing liquidity to illiquid assets. And in fact, what we found over the years is that the biggest product market fit for tokenization has been stablecoins so far, which is expressly the opposite. It's tokenizing the most liquid asset, which is the US dollar. And I would say the second, and he pointed this out, Omid, the second was that we've seen traction on is sovereign debt, right? Treasuries, right? The second, you've got Franklin Templeton and BlackRock and others that are tokenizing, creating on-chain money market funds. Money market funds own national debt. They own treasuries, right? Mm-hmm. And so then you say to yourself, well, what's the third? Okay, now it looks like it's more about giving access to existing highly liquid. Those seem to be working. One and two are the most liquid in the world. What's three?
Right.
U.S. equities, right? So maybe, and just today I saw at Davos, Larry Fink, BlackRock CEO, was explicitly talking about tokenizing bonds and equities.
Wow.
So I think you're likely to get...
He would not say that unless he was already cooking on something.
Yeah, I think you're likely to, and they've already been tokenizing bonds too with mm-hmm. Biddle. So I think you're likely to get at a minimum some sandbox environments and proof of concept state, you know, areas at the SEC where, say, a tokenization company and an issuer, as in like a company who issues stock, and maybe like a major national securities exchange, sort of all come in and they say, we want to tokenize 1,000 shares of, you know, ticker XYZ or whatever it is. And just like, you know, okay, how can we do that? And maybe they'll say the SEC will, we know, I'm pretty sure the SEC is going to say, let's figure out how we can do that in a limited way. And then we'll study it all together and figure out the path forward. And so you'll get things like, oh, well, you can only do it for 1,000 shares and they have to be to an accredited investor. So you're great. You go find like some high net worth person or a family office that also wants to be part of the experiment, right? And then you sort of try things like, okay, well, how's FINRA gets from all the brokerage firms like a daily reporting called Blue Sheet Reporting, which is just like all the trades the brokerage firm did. Okay, well, how do we get that to FINRA, the SEC might ask. And literally, there's some guy at FINRA who has to receive these every day. How can he get it in the exact same format that he currently gets it from Fidelity, from Ethereum, right? So mm-hmm. so then it would be like, okay, like help set him up with a node and like we'll create an indexer for him. We can pull the data, forget every day. You can just see it in real time if he wants to, right? Or export under any time frame. You go through all those stages. And I think eventually you do get to a place where you can, in some way, NYSE can adopt a decentralized trading infrastructure if they might want to. And issuers could choose to either dual issue both on a blockchain or not. I think it's very likely that over the next 4 years, we see significant movement on that.
Wow, Alex, that is as bullish as it comes. Thinking that some of our regulators are going to actually start to become crypto native and run some local infra in order to do their jobs. That's as, I think, as bullish and optimistic as it comes. And I'm absolutely here for it. Alex, thank you so much for joining me on Bankless today and helping me work through all this news.
Yeah, thank you, David.
Alex, if people want to just hear more from you, maybe they liked your takes, maybe they liked the sound of your voice, where should they go to get more of it?
Yeah, check me out on Twitter or on x.com, a great website, x.com. Intangible Coins is my handle there. And check our content. We publish a lot of research at galaxy.com/research.
Awesome. We'll get all those links in the show notes of the podcast and on the YouTube. Bankless Nation, thank you so much for tuning in. If you're watching on the YouTube, make sure to give us a like and subscribe where we cover any time Trump talks about crypto, we're probably going to cover it. So if you want more of that content, make sure you subscribe to the YouTube and give us a 5-star review in your podcast app. We really appreciate it. Bankless Nation, you guys know the deal. Crypto is risky. You can lose what you put in. But nonetheless, we are headed west. This is a frontier. It's not for everyone, but we are glad you are with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot. With over $1.5 billion in TVL, the METH protocol is home to METH, the fourth largest ETH liquid staking token, offering one of the highest APRs among the top 10 LSTs. And now, CMETH takes things even further. This restaked version captures multiple yields across Kerak, Eigenlayer, Symbiotic, and many more, making CMETH the most efficient and most composable LRT solution on the market. Metamorphosis Season 1 dropped $7.7 million in Cook rewards to METH holders. Season 2 is currently ongoing, allowing users to earn staking, restaking and AVS yields, plus rewards in Cook, METH Protocol's governance token, and more. Don't miss out on the opportunity to stake, restake, and shape the future of METH Protocol with Cook. Participate today at meth.mantle.xyz. Zello is transitioning from a mobile-first, EVM-compatible Layer 1 blockchain to a high-performance Ethereum Layer 2, built on OP Stack with EigenDA and one-block finality. All happening soon with a hard fork. With over 600 million total transactions, 12 million weekly transactions, and 750,000 daily active users, Zello's meteoric rise would place it among one of the top layer twos, built for the real world and optimized for fast, low-cost global payments. As the home of the stablecoins, Zello hosts 13 native stablecoins across 7 different currencies, including native USDT on Opera MiniPay, and with over 4 million users in Africa alone. In November, stablecoin volumes hit $6.8 billion, made for seamless on-chain FX trading. Plus, users can pay gas with ERC-20 tokens like USDT and USDC and send crypto to phone numbers in seconds. But why should you care about Zello's transition to a layer two? Layer twos unify Ethereum. L1s fragment it. By becoming a layer two, Zello leads the way for other EVM-compatible layer ones to follow. Follow Zello on X and witness the great Zello halving, where Zello cuts its inflation in half as it enters its layer two era and continuing its environmental leadership. The Arbitrum portal is your one-stop hub to entering the Ethereum ecosystem. With over 800 apps, Arbitrum offers something for everyone. Dive into the epicenter of DeFi, where advanced trading, lending, and staking platforms are redefining how we interact with money. Explore Arbitrum's rapidly growing gaming hub, from immersed role-playing games, fast-paced fantasy MMOs, to casual luck battle mobile games. Move assets effortlessly between chains and access the ecosystem with ease via Arbitrum's expansive network of bridges and on-ramps. Step into Arbitrum's flourishing NFT and creator space, where artists, collectors, and social converge, and support your favorite streamers all on-chain. Find new and trending apps and learn how to earn rewards across the Arbitrum ecosystem with limited time campaigns from your favorite projects. Empower your future with Arbitrum. Visit portal.arbitrum.io to find out what's next on your Web3 journey.